WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello. You're listening to Radio Catskill.
Live from WJFF Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, it's Friday and Dan Hoost is here from Sullivan County Government for the latest from Monticello. We check in with Philip Pantuso at the Hudson Valley. He's the Hudson Valley Bureau Editor for the Times Union. Talk about a few stories, including New York restricting dairy cattle imports due to an avian flu outbreak in other states. Plus, a dance party at NACL tomorrow night celebrating Beltane. We'll tell you what that is, and the plans to party like it's 1999 or 1979 or any night in between. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Thousands of students are taking part in demonstrations on college campuses around the country in protest of the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza. That includes several universities in the Boston area. Jeremy Siegel from member station GBH reports more than 100 students have been arrested.
Roughly 200 students at Northeastern University set up an encampment in support of the people of Gaza. Graduating senior August Escondon says they were met with a heavy law enforcement response, including police officers in riot gear.
We're camping out in solidarity with the people in Gaza. We really want to bring awareness to this, and we want to stay here until Northeastern hears our demands, and then we'd leave immediately.
Escondon and other students say they want the school to disclose and cut their ties to Israel. Students at Harvard are also demonstrating, despite warnings from university officials that they could face disciplinary action. And early Thursday morning, more than 100 students protesting at Emerson College were arrested by police. For NPR News, I'm Jeremy Siegel in Boston.
And other protests around the country have been peaceful. The Manhattan District Attorney says he will retry former Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein if the alleged victims are willing to come forward again. Yesterday, the New York Court of Appeals overturned Weinstein's 2020 conviction on sex crimes against three women, saying he didn't get a fair trial. He was also convicted of rape in California and will be transferred to prison authorities there. The Attorney General of Arkansas is joining a lawsuit with other Republican state attorneys general over abortion rights protections. Josie Lenora of Little Rock Public Radio has more.
The Pregnant Workers Fairness Act prohibits organizations from discriminating against pregnant workers. The law, which passed in 2022 and went into effect last year, requires companies to give pregnant workers reasonable accommodations. Last week, the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission adopted a rule to expand these protections to include abortions. This means workers seeking an abortion could get paid time off or other workplace accommodations. Arkansas Attorney General Tim Griffin is joining other attorney generals from 16 other states in a suit to stop the new rule from going into effect in June. The lawsuit says the EEOC Commission's decision hijacks pregnancy protections and violates the Constitution. For NPR News, I'm Josie Lenora in Little Rock.
One of the Fed's favorite inflation guides shows little sign of letting up in March. The Commerce Department says the core personal consumption expenditures price index, which excludes volatile food and energy prices, rose 2.8% in March year over year, the same as it was in February, but that was only slightly higher than economists were expecting. But spending was higher, up 0.8%, while personal incomes rose only 0.5%. Wall Street's trading higher at this hour, Dow up 186 points. This is NPR. Scotland's leader is mulling his political future amid plans for a no-confidence vote in the Scottish Parliament next week. NPR's Lauren Freyer has more from London.
A little over a year ago, Hamza Yousaf became the first person of color, the first Muslim, and the youngest person ever to serve as Scotland's first minister. But his governing coalition crumbled this week after the Scottish Green Party pulled out in a dispute over climate change targets. Yousaf faces a no-confidence vote next week, which he may not survive. This is the latest chapter in the implosion of Yousaf's Scottish National Party, or SNP. Its separatist leaders came close to winning independence from Britain in a 2014 referendum. But financial fraud allegations then led to the arrests of Yousaf's predecessor, Nicola Sturgeon, and her husband. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
A lab in a Dutch zoo says special corals that bred themselves have been nestled in Europe's largest coral reef. The corals are part of a project by the World Coral Conservatory to create a bank of corals in aquariums across Europe. They could eventually be used to repopulate wild coral reefs that are succumbing to the stresses of climate change or pollution. The scientists took more than a dozen coral fragments from off the coast of the Seychelles in East Africa and then propagated them in a lab. Once they were large enough, they were brought to join the rest of the reef. The Dow is up 195 points. That's up more than 0.5%. The NASDAQ is up 278 points. That's up about 1.8%. S&P 500 is up 51. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include USPS, dedicated to providing businesses with shipping options. Working to help businesses avoid shipping challenges with USPS Ground Advantage. Learn more at usps.com/advantage.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Every Friday, we hear from Dan Hoost, the communications director at Sullivan County Government. And he's joining us now with the latest from Monticello. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. Happy Friday.
To you as well.
The latest from Monticello is that the legislature didn't meet yesterday, but that was per schedule. They did not meet yesterday, but there was plenty of things going on that you could tell us about.
Oh, I thought the latest from Monticello, it's sunny, it's a nice day, it's spring. You want to talk about county government?
I want to talk about government, local government. Doesn't everyone?
Actually, I do too.
I know. So let's talk about some traffic things that might impact some folks. County Route 58, starting Monday, is going to be repaved. Let's talk about where that is and what's going on, how long it might impact traffic.
Yeah, I always make sure when I put these things out, our DPW folks, they're great. They do a great job, but they know these routes by their numbers. You and I
don't know.
Have no idea. I mean, it's really confusing when we have a county Route 52 that is not New York State Route 52, but does connect to New York State Route 52. So I make sure that I tell people what the county route names are. In this case, County Route 58, I believe it is, yes, is Glen Wild Road. So this is the county road that connects Woodridge to Rock Hill, or Rock Hill to Woodridge if you're going the other way. Some people get picky about what town's first there. So starting this Monday, its entire 6 miles will begin to be repaved. It is that time of the year now where we're getting out there and repaving. We are going to be doing some other roads as well. This is the first one. There will not be any full closure of the road, but obviously there's going to have to be some rolling lane closures. We ask people to just obey the flag people, go slow. It's a 35 mile per hour speed limit, and be patient. There are going to be delays. There are other alternative routes. There's a county route that actually sort of comes in from Maston Lake to Mountaindale. You could take that if you want instead. But not only on this one, but all the others moving forward. Just give our guys, how's the state put it, give our guys a break. Oh, and one last thing. Sullivan County is not responsible for New York State Route 17. I know there's been a lot of talk about the potholes on 17. I drive over them. I know what people are talking about.
I got to tell you.
The state has started to patch them, but the county, we posted this actually about County Route 58, and somebody immediately said, why don't you do 17 first? And I'm like, that's not us.
I was traveling to Monticello yesterday, and I can report that the state was out there repairing
yes.
a few of those, but man, oh man, on that stretch, even from here to Liberty from Monticello, just in that right lane, lots of damage on the road.
Well, for weeks, I've been seeing it because, of course, I come here every Friday, so I head back to Monticello on 17, and it's been an unusual traffic pattern where most of the traffic is in the left lane,
yeah.
no matter what speed they're going, because they want to avoid the potholes.
Exactly.
But they're being fixed.
Okay. And there's other work that's going to be ongoing considering the time. It's warming up springtime. That's when these things happen.
Construction season.
Yep. Work is expected to take about a week on County Route 58 or Glen Wild Road, weather permitting. Also, blood drive we want to get out there today at 2:30 at the Government Center.
Yes, happening as we speak at the Government Center, 100 North Street in Monticello, in our hearing room where normally you see legislators legislating. You will actually find nurses taking blood, and eagerly so, because there is always a blood shortage. We need blood all the time. We tend to have a core group of folks who always show up for this, but we need more than just that core group to show up. So if you have just a few minutes of availability, we'll get you in and out as fast as we can. We'll take good care of you. It runs till 2:30 today.
And the Red Cross declared an emergency blood shortage earlier this year. Blood supplies at a 20-year low. So again, if you can, please donate the blood drive today, 2:30 at the Government Center. Okay, since there was no meeting for the legislature yesterday, you went on a field trip.
Yes, we did. We brought Aileen Gunther, our assemblywoman, too, and she's like, I love road trips. Let's keep doing this. So, you know, for somebody who definitely knows her district very well, it made me realize she doesn't get a chance that often to get out just to go on a little road trip someplace. It's always business, business, business. And we thank her for that, but it was really nice to be able to give her that sort of thrill. We also did for our legislators, show them our different areas of our O&W rail trail where we're going to be doing some pretty big, interesting projects, all towards the ultimate goal of connecting our disparate rail trail segments throughout Sullivan County. I've been on all of them. I am a railroad buff, and I also like to be hiking and biking, and these are nice and flat, so they're fun to do. We started at what we are calling our Neversink Crossing, which is where the O&W used to cross the Neversink River between Woodridge and South Fallsburg. The piers are still there. The bridge is long gone. The metal was taken down decades ago and recycled as scrap. But we are going to be putting in a prefabricated pedestrian and bicycle-friendly bridge, not motorized vehicle, just walkers and bikers. And it's going to be about $3.2 million, of which I think Aileen is going to give us the final bit of funding to get us over the hump with that. So I would hope by this time next year that we're talking about actually construction going on. The design is finished, and it will connect the Woodridge and Mountaindale sections of the O&W Rail Trail to South Fallsburg, because there's going to be an extension of the trail. The trail actually would lead directly into the Fallsburg Tunnel. We're not going to rehab the tunnel. We're going to create a trail that sort of climbs up around it. But then when you get into South Fallsburg, you'll come upon another section of the O&W Rail Trail. And then we went up to Hurleyville, which, of course, has got the most popular part of the trail. It's an actually paved part of the trail. And then we went on to Parksville, where they're going to be putting in a little bridge to connect the Parksville section to an upcoming section that leads to Livingston Manor, where we finalized our tour. And they're building a bridge, too, across, I think it's the little Beaver Kill up there. Might be the Willowy, but I'd have to look at the map again. But so that they can connect with the Parksville section, and the trail will go all the way up to Rotary Park, which is basically right near downtown Livingston Manor. If you've ever been to their ice carnival, that's where they hold it. And who knows where we'll be going from there.
Now, the rail trail, I mean, these are, O&W is a very large railroad, so there, it's not just Sullivan County. Like this, right. There's the trails all throughout the region. This plan is to connect everything in Sullivan County.
Yes, although there is a plan.
Will it connect?
We hope to connect to Orange County. Our Orange County's Commissioner of Planning happens to be our very own Alan Sorensen, Rock Hill resident and former longtime county legislator, and he is very big on this. He got all this going in Sullivan County, and he is shepherding it now down in Orange County. And he wants to see their trail connect with ours. Now, of course, there are still some things to deal with there. There's a tunnel that is in the mountain between Wurtsboro and Bloomingburg. We would have to bypass that. That's extremely unsafe. But then we find places where maybe we can go along the road, or we can create another path. And you really will get some beautiful views from that area. That one station there was called Highview above Bloomingburg. And then down into Orange County, sort of horse farm country that the O&W runs. So we could end up in just a few years having quite a long trail running from Orange County into Sullivan. Up into Delaware, it gets a little trickier because once you get north of Livingston Manor, just like sort of Route 17, the O&W had to take bridge after bridge after bridge to cross that very curvy section of the Beaver Kill. So that becomes a lot more expensive, but there's little pieces of that already, like the Catskill Fly Fishing Center in Livingston Manor has a section of the O&W trail open. It's a beautiful walk.
I mean, within Sullivan County, there are 50 miles of the trail.
Mm-hmm.
Is the incentive, is the enthusiasm for this not just the beauty, the views, the health and wellness aspect of hiking, but also the economic impact?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's the, I think they have determined, where was it? I think it was in the Orange County area. They were realizing there was like $750,000 economic impact from this, and we want to see that too. We've been seeing that. We talked to Lisa Lyons from Morgan Outdoors. She moved her hiking and biking shop from Manor down to Hurleyville. She's right next to the rail trail there.
For that reason.
And she sees a lot of business there. But also the restaurants, the gas stations, and a whole bunch of other shops that are in these downtowns. Because, of course, the railroad was meant to service these downtowns. Sometimes it's why these downtowns even began to exist in the first place. So let's see if we can return some traffic there.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Dan Hoost. He's the communications director for Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday. Let's talk about the Summer Youth Employment Program. We've mentioned this before, but I want to make sure that the youth know of some opportunities this summer.
Yeah, this is an excellent opportunity for anyone aged 14 to 20 years old. So basically, your middle and older teenagers. It's for the economically disadvantaged, so there are some eligibility requirements with that. But I think most teens and families in Sullivan County would definitely qualify for this because we are an economically disadvantaged area. It is run through our Center for Workforce Development. They've done this before. It's usually groups of young people led by a team leader who go and do all sorts of interesting projects. This is everything from litter plucking to gardening. They try to make it something that's meaningful for the students. It's not just rote work. You're certainly learning work skills, but you're also learning life skills as you go along with this. So encourage people. The application deadline is just a month away, May 31st. You can apply by calling our Center for Workforce Development. That's 845-794-3340, 794-3340. Or you can go to sullivanworks.org, sullivanworks.org. Krista Berger is the one that you're going to be talking to. She is so passionate about giving kids a chance to really shine and find out what they love to do.
And, you know, I don't want to mischaracterize the youth, but if it's not on a phone, it might be more of a challenge. How is this application process? Is it kind of straightforward for folks? Or
And the parent or the guardian has to be involved. Okay. This is something where it's fine for them to fill it all out on behalf of their kids. I'm sure there have been some situations where they tell the teenager, I don't care, you're going to go like this. So, but we try to, once the kids are there, we try to make it really meaningful and enjoyable for them because we want them to get excited about, well, what's just a couple years away, if not right at their doorstep, the real world of work.
Well, and also the Sullivan County Career Center offers opportunities to learn more about resume building and interviewing resources. There's other opportunities.
And we talk to them about that, too. It's not always that they're out digging in the dirt or picking up garbage or whatever. We're talking about building their careers and how to do that. So
I don't want to mischaracterize the youth, but
it's a challenge.
It is.
But if you ever, we may bring Krista Berger on the show here because she is a force to be reckoned with, and she brings such passion and yet such a way to relate to young people. We couldn't have a better person in that position.
Speaking of youth, there's some funding available from the Youth Bureau. What kind of funding is that and for whom?
Yeah, we just gave out $150,000 worth of funding the legislature approved for various youth organizations. This is another round. I didn't know this was coming, but this one is focusing, I don't know the exact amount of money available, but I'm sure it's tens of thousands, if not over $100,000, for intergenerational activities. This is what they really want to focus on now.
What does that mean?
Which is means that with the old fogies like you and me, right?
I'm up there.
All right, like me, maybe.
No, like me. No, I'm up there. That's why I'm saying the kids and their phones. Yeah, right.
This is connecting us with the younger folks and finding ways for us to spend time together and do enjoyable activities and events together, so that we connect the generations. You know, I have nephews and nieces who won't hesitate to say Uncle Dan is old and bald and all that good stuff, but they also love spending time with me, and I love spending time with them. I remember when I was a kid and we would go to the local nursing home as a school field trip, and we'd sing and visit with the older folks. I loved it because I learned so much about history, which I still love to this day. So those kinds of connections are important and can last a lifetime. for the young people who are involved with it. So if you are a nonprofit organization or just a small group of committed individuals who want to see some intergenerational activities happen, contact our youth bureau. They will be happy to talk to you. 845-807-0394.
Do you have some examples of some of the funding that went out for some of these activities, some of the intergenerational?
It hasn't gone out yet. The applications are being accepted.
Oh, I see. So, the funding went.
No. The funding last time was just for various different youth programs.
So this is the new one.
This is a new round of funding. The application deadline, I believe, is at the end of May.
See, I'm old. I'm not paying attention.
That's okay.
We'll take a quick break and have more with Dan Hoost, the young and vibrant and, well, not full of head of hair.
I was going to say, so you say.
I was looking to see. It's actually a shadow. Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government. He'll have more right after a break. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org, and from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Callison Stratton, a singer-songwriter, public historian, and host of Liberation Station here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Liberation Station is a show that highlights the work of female and femme-presenting performers across genre and time. It's my little way of balancing the scales of representation on the radio. Join me for Liberation Station every Saturday evening at 7 p.m., only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
This week on Science Friday, silk is a powerhouse of a fabric, and it has incredible biological properties.
It is said that if a spider was the size of a human, the web that we made would be strong enough to stop a jetliner.
Plus, the effort to protect your neurological rights. Who owns your brain data? That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Today, from 2 to 4 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and we're speaking with Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government. Let's talk about the fire commissioner's training at the training center. I think we talked about this before, about the training that's offered there. But tell us a little bit more about that. But also want to talk about the differences between the fire commissioner, the fire district, the fire department.
Yeah, actually,
different delineations there.
Actually, it was a little different what we had talked about before, and this
oh,
is why
the state police.
This is no. It was with fire coordinators, not fire commissioners.
Yet another one. Okay. Oh.
So
walk me through this.
This was really interesting. I first when I saw this come through, I'm like, okay, it's a training at our training center. What's new and different about that? Of course, and I love that we have it and we're doing it. But of course, with me, I was like, well, what's the press release worthiness of this material? Well, I took a look and I was very humbled about it. I was like, my goodness, I didn't know we did this kind of training. This is for fire commissioners. We know about firefighters. We know about fire chiefs. We know about other kinds of first responders. But unless you're really involved with the fire department or the taxing district that oversees it, a fire district, you may not know that there's actually a board of fire commissioners for every fire district that we have, which I think is upward of 50 here in Sullivan County.
Just in this county?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, because I think we have 54 fire departments, and I think most of them are just under their own district. There could be one or two that might be merged under a single district, I think, like maybe in Liberty. But these taxing districts exist so that the fire departments can be properly funded through what's called a fire tax on your property tax bill. But who figures out what that tax is going to be? Well, it's actually these fire commissioners.
Uh-huh.
And that's just one of a whole bunch of duties that they have that we want to make sure they're properly trained for, because they're overseeing the public's money, but they're also overseeing how a fire department gets and spends its money. These may or may not be actual active firefighters. They may, you know, be especially folks who have been active in the past and now maybe are older and aren't really up for going out to a fire scene, but they still want to serve their district. They're elected to by, I believe, the board to the Board of Fire Commissioners, and they make all sorts of monetary decisions. They make all sorts of appointments and other decisions on who's going to be the officers on that board. They just do very important work. And so our emergency training facility is a perfect location to bring in an expert, which we did, a guy named, Greg Cirio, who is an experienced instructor. And he spent, I think, a few hours with them just going over all the different things that they need to pay attention to. Because especially when you're working with taxpayers' money, then there becomes a lot of reporting requirements, a lot of financial duties and separation of duties as well. So I'm really proud that we're so forward-thinking that we're providing this instruction through our emergency services training facility. I don't think we're required by law to provide it, but we do. And it makes sure that all these fire departments and their board of commissioners overseeing their districts can just go locally, not maybe having to travel to Kingston or Middletown or Poughkeepsie to get this kind of training. Super important training.
So do the districts correlate with the towns and the villages in the county? Are they separate?
Mm-hmm. They correlate to typically the boundaries of the fire department service area. So, and for example, there's a Rockland Fire Department. It's a Roscoe-Rockland Fire District corresponds to the boundaries, which I think actually extend for that fire district into Delaware County as well, because they serve part of that as well. Mm-hmm. So, but these are the folks, these boards, who determine what you're going to be paying and maybe what to put up for vote if there's a big purchase of a fire truck or something like that. They're not necessarily the ones, they can be, but they're typically not the ones out there fighting the fires. But they have just as important a job to do.
So when you talk about training for them, this is not fighting the fire. This is fighting the accountant. it is more financially oriented training.
Yeah. It's about their roles and responsibilities. I would make it more akin to the kind of ongoing education that our planning board, zoning board, town board members have to get. It's the same thing. You're overseeing a budget in a taxing entity. You need to know what you're doing to properly carry out those duties.
All right. We mentioned a lot over the winter about the warming centers that were available in the area. You have a report on, how the use of those were. Of course, those have closed now as of mid-April. What can you tell us about?
Yeah, I don't have absolutely final numbers, but I have the most of it. As of March 31st, our warming centers, which closed, I think, April 15th, saw over or almost 2,000 visits, 657 in Liberty and 1,060 in Monticello from the start of the season, which was late November, to March 31st. Health and Human Services Commissioner John Little told me that the peak number that we served was 43 in Monticello in March, actually, which surprised me. I would have thought more like January. And the peak in Liberty was 25 in any given month. However, we served far more than that over the entire amount of the season. So these warming centers are absolutely needed, even though I would say this was one of the warmer winters I've ever experienced. But we were glad to have that there whenever people needed it. They were open 7 nights a week from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. We worked with our partners over at the Liberty United Methodist Church and then in Monticello at St. John's Episcopal Church, worked with the Federation for the Homeless. We are so grateful to our partners on this, because without them, we couldn't have made this happen.
And the plans are to open the warming centers again in winter this year, I assume. Mm-hmm. Is there any plan to open more, or is it still the plan to have just the two for now?
I think we would love to, but I haven't talked to our team about whether or not, and I'm not sure that they've figured that out yet. It's always a matter of funding and manpower. But we definitely want to be able to be there for folks who need us in emergencies. And I think we are. We have, as we talked about, I think last week, a growing homeless population as well. So we really are stepping it up to make sure that we can help these people out when they come and need help from us. Some folks are just like, leave me alone. But a lot of them are in this situation involuntarily, and we want to be there to help them. So even if somebody had an issue and the warming center was too far away or whatever, if they called us up or called their local police department, or if it was life-threatening, called 911, our team would respond no matter the day or time of the week.
It was a mild winter. Do these numbers correlate with that compared to last year? Do you have the numbers from last year?
I don't have the numbers from last year, but I do think that it's a little bit less than it has been in years past, which isn't a bad thing. This is one of those issues where we want people to be able to find their own spot to be during the night. I mean, who wants to stay in a warming center? You have to if you have to. But you never know how cold or not it's going to be. And I think this is going to be a continuing fixture. It was only, I think, last year that we went to the 7 days a week or seven nights a week service. I think that's going to is here to stay.
Also, in terms of how you communicate and how the county communicates, not just coming on air to talk to us, the county manager puts out a newsletter to read. Can you tell us about the latest from the Sullivan County Manager's newsletter?
I try to get as widespread distribution with this as possible, but I know, being a communications person, there's always somebody who's like, I didn't hear about that. I didn't know about that. So this is part of my ongoing effort to have you know about this. I put out with the county manager, Josh Potosik, a newsletter every other month called Inside Insights. Say that three times fast. And it's what it is exactly what that title means. It's some insights into more of the inner workings of government, some of the things that we're working on that you may not have heard about, things that Josh finds interesting and wants to share with the public. From a perspective, sometimes it includes legislature, but more from the rank and file county employees. What are we up to? The cover story in the issue that just came out is about the old Route 17 corridor infrastructure project, which I don't know if people have heard about. And if you have, it might have been a while. We are working with the town and village of Liberty and the town of Thompson, but mostly in the town of Liberty, to develop the corridor on Old 17, sort of between the Ferndale and Harris exits of New 17, but it's on Old 17, because there are a lot of parcels there that are very interesting to developers. They're zoned industrial commercial, and they might be great for light industry, manufacturing, warehouse, office space, but they don't have water or sewer. Well, the closest place to get that is from the town and the village of Liberty. So we've been working for several years with them, actually, now to wend our way through the different things we need to do on this. Congressman Molinaro just got us $1 million in the federal budget to continue our design work on this to ultimately extend water and sewer lines from, I think they're sort of in the Ferndale area, south along Old 17 into the town of Thompson, so that we can basically have shovel-ready sites there. We've been working very close with the Partnership for Economic Development, Mark Baez, their CEO. He is eager beyond belief to shop these things around because he already knows the interest is there. People are finding that farther downstate, it's costlier, there's less room for any kind of development. We've got something that's already zoned what it should be in a place that I think 99.9% of people won't have a problem with us putting industrial commercial applications there. But the key thing that these developers need is water and sewer service. We don't have it. So that's the plan now. And I've sort of just given you the whole article that was in the newsletter there, but there are more things than just that. We have more about the new airport terminal. We have a number of things about we're studying our water resources throughout Sullivan County. We're getting ready to do that to find out anywhere in Sullivan County what's underground in terms of water resources, which is crucially important.
Well, it's some of the things we talk about every Friday. If you haven't been able to memorize all of those, you can go to the newsletter and check that out.
It's at the county website and also on our social media channels. I try to spread it all around. And soon it'll be going to the local libraries as well.
Let's talk about a surprise for one of our local vets, Dr. Joe. Tell us about why this was something that came up to the legislative level.
This is really fun. I enjoyed this. Our public health team called me up a few months ago and said, do you know Dr. Nebzadowski, Joseph Nebzadowski, Youngsville Veterinary Clinic? I said, do I know him? I've been going to him for years with my animals. So they said, well, he is always giving at low cost, and I think sometimes at no cost, his services to us for our rabies vaccination clinics that we hold every few months in locations around the county through Sullivan County's Department of Public Health. So they said, well, we just want to thank him for everything he's done. He's a very modest, you know, no attitude kind of guy. And so they said, we'd like to surprise him with this. Maybe, you know, well, they I think public health employees personally bought some lunch for his employees as well. And so they said, do you think the legislators would back doing a resolution in his honor officially in a certificate? I said, do you think so? Of course, I think so. So I got that all done, created that, had a nice frame around it and everything. And then we snuck over to the Youngsville Veterinary Clinic earlier this week, and we presented it with it. We had to wait for a while because he was on the phone forever and ever and ever. Meanwhile, his employees are puttering around all nervous saying, he's going to kill us. He's going to kill us because we didn't tell him about this. But when he came out, he was delighted. He was genuinely touched. I've hardly ever seen that man smile. He's always so business and by the book, which I love about him. I really do. But it was so nice to see him smile and say, I really appreciate this. Thank you. It meant something to him. And we were all able to be there, legislators, public health employees, myself. I took some pictures and put it on social media just to tell him thank you, because you could charge us a lot more than what you are. You could say you weren't available, you want to focus on your business, but every time we need him, he's there for us, not just during the vaccination clinics, but if we have rabies exposure, he's one that can respond to that as well, because we need somebody to go find the animal, test it, that kind of thing. He is always there for us, and just give him a great shout out here on the radio to add to what we did with this certificate that I think he's going to actually hang on his wall. Because, you know, people deserve to know how much of a giving person he really is.
Thank you, Dr. Joe. And the vaccine clinics, are those happening? Are they?
Yeah, the next one is June. I don't remember the date offhand, but next time I come back here, I can bring that information. There's not one coming up, I think, too quickly here. I think we just had one.
Right. And before we go, I want to mention something that just came out today, a concert at the Frederick Cook Museum.
At the County Museum.
County Museum.
It was sponsored by the Frederick Cook Society, which happens to sit there. Frederick Cook Society, for those who don't know about it, is a nonprofit society independent of the county, but housed at the County Museum in Hurleyville, that celebrates and studies the life of Dr. Frederick Cook, who was born in Hortonville, right here in Sullivan County, and explored the North Pole and summited different mountains. He's a controversial figure. Mm-hmm. Some people don't necessarily believe he did all these things, but we happen to. He's our hometown guy, and there's certainly evidence for it, very much so. He actually lived quite a fascinating life. So our Cook Society, which is headed by one Carol Troiani, who I think you happen to know here.
Maybe.
She and her husband Aldo also, of course, are part of the band Little Sparrow. And they have created this concert series, usually the first Sunday of every month at the County Museum, that brings in all sorts of talented, usually locally connected musicians. They're going to be performing again this Sunday, May 5th, with Henry Simon, who's a Sullivan West senior that's very talented.
We know Henry.
Yes, you know him well. But the actual folks who are going to be the main attraction that day, who will only be there for that day, are a husband-wife duo named Kevin Eeg, I think, and Sue Stegmaier. They together perform traditional Americana and bluegrass music, and they will be performing that starting at 2 p.m. on Sunday the 5th at the County Museum. This concert series has grown hugely in popularity. Last one that they had, which was a really talented guitarist, named Paul Kogut, I think is his name, had over 75 people attend. And it's in a gymnatorium in the museum, which is a former school. So that, I'm sure, was an impressive turnout. There's usually refreshments. You get to mingle with folks in the area. And you also can go through the museum at no cost and see all the wonderful exhibits we have there. So encourage people to turn out and keep it on their calendar. Keep that first Sunday of every month open.
We just had our tiny porch concert last Saturday, and some of the folks you mentioned were here performing. And I have to say, like, just to, you know, ours was outside, so it was a little iffy with the weather, but it was so great to see the community come together, and the music was great. Paul Kogut was there, Henry Little Sparrow. So yeah, really fun to get together and hear this local music.
And people love getting together and just enjoying a group activity. We don't do that often enough in this modern society. So
Come on out.
Well, I enjoy our group activity here with you every Friday. Dan Hoost, who is the Sullivan County Government's Communications Specialist Director. What did I say it wrong?
Communications Director.
Specialist.
I guess I specialize in it, but Director of Communications. But it's okay. I'm known as Dan. Usually it's like, oh, Dan from the Democrat, from my days working at the Sullivan County Democrat.
So. You're special to me. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, checking in with the Hudson Valley Bureau of the Times Union, some news about New York State temporarily restricting import requirements for dairy cattle. We'll learn more after a break. This is Radio Chatsko.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Roy Blunt Jr. came up with a great idea to make our news quiz even more exciting.
Want to see a lobster fight an eel?
I'm Peter Sagal. While we wait to get approval from the FCC for that, tune into this week's show with Hamilton and Girls 5 Eva star Renee Elise Goldsberry and special guest panelist Jason Isbell. That's Wait, Wait from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. This week, New York State announced temporary import requirements for dairy cattle coming into the state following detections of the highly pathogenic avian flu influenza in dairy cattle and goats in other states. The New York State Department of Agriculture and Markets said no cases have been detected in New York livestock to date, and the USDA continues to confirm there's no threat to human health. Jason Dole spoke to Philip Pantuso of the Hudson Valley Bureau at the Times Union for more on that and other stories.
So I'm sure listeners will have heard or seen on the news about the avian flu outbreak that's happening right now. So this is a strain of avian flu H5N1 virus that is highly pathogenic, according to virologists. And, most troublingly, I think, has leapt into different species. So usually when there's an avian flu outbreak, it really just impacts sort of domesticated birds, most notably chickens, and then sometimes it'll leap into wild birds. But this one is jumping into all kinds of different animals, and from bottlenose dolphins to there's a huge die-off of sea lions in South America. It's also getting into all kinds of land mammals, including dairy cattle. So this week, the State Department of Agriculture and Markets put restrictions on New York State importing dairy cattle from 8 states that have reported outbreaks of the virus. This will include a ban on importing cattle from any premises where there is a confirmed case, and for any importation at all from any of the states, a certificate of veterinary inspection is required 10 days prior to the importation. The Agricultural Department also stressed that the virus doesn't pose a human threat, and that pasteurized milk remains safe to consume. They're framing this essentially as a way of trying to limit the virus from making further inroads into New York State. Because often what happens in this case is, or in cases like this, is that when a farm has a confirmed case of this virus, they have to basically kill what normally would happen is they would kill all the chickens because that's where it used to spread. And the federal Ag Department would give them reimbursements for that, but the point is to try to keep it from spreading, right? So you can't, now it's spreading into all these different species, you can't exactly kill off everything in your farm, but you can limit and put restrictions on sending those animals across state lines and potentially spreading the virus that way.
And now New York State, there's a housing crisis. We've been talking about the high housing crisis, especially for affordable housing, especially in our region, the suburban and rural areas outside of New York City and the tri-state area. You've got some news on more affordable housing coming to Ulster County. Is that right?
Yeah, this is in the town of Lloyd, and it's going to be a 57-unit affordable housing development, primarily for seniors who are in some ways uniquely squeezed by the affordable housing crisis in suburban and rural areas of upstate New York, in part because there have been so many zoning restrictions on the type of housing that gets built. You know, what ends up happening a lot of times is seniors will kind of just age in place in houses that may not be best suited to their mobility needs, or just maybe too much space now that maybe, you know, maybe they have kids and they moved out. And so this is, you know, a housing complex that's going to have senior services and programming that will be affordable, and it's getting paid for by a bunch of state funds. And RUPCO, here in Ulster County, is the supportive service provider. They, among many other initiatives that they have, they also operate senior housing at Landmark Place in Kingston, which is a huge senior housing complex in the former Kingston Almshouse. So it's going to be a while before this opens. They just broke ground this week, but it's going to be a $22 million development that will comprise a single three-story building with 57 one-bedroom apartments. And it's reserved for New Yorkers 62 and older, earning at or below 60% of the area median income.
When you say 57 units, what does that mean, like an apartment? That means more than one or two people can live in there?
So it's 57 one-bedroom apartments. So probably not too many more than two. Certainly, you know, a married couple or partners could live in a one-bedroom apartment, but probably not too many more than that. I should also note that almost half, or a little more than half, actually, of those apartments are going to be specifically set aside for seniors who are experiencing homelessness, according to the governor's office.
All right. I heard that Ulster County has a nature bus. Is this a totally new service?
Yes, this is a new service, and this is definitely good news. So this is a program that was actually initially announced by Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger at her State of the County address back in February, but it is going to officially start this weekend, and it's the Nature Bus. It's basically a free bus that will take Ulster County residents to natural landscapes and attractions across the county, from state parks to the walkway over the Hudson to Kingston Point Bridge, and everywhere in between. It's an additional service, basically, of Ulster County Area Transit, UCAT, which is the county's bus service, which is already free. Former County Executive Pat Ryan made it free in 2022 using, I think, Inflation Reduction Act money. So UCAT service is already free, but these are going to be additional service that's going to run on Saturdays on a rotating basis, starting this Saturday, April 27th, through October 12th. And what I mean by rotating basis is there's three routes that pick up in different places and take you to different natural parks and landscapes across the county. And the other cool thing about this is that while the bus is free, or the bus was already free, if you take the Nature Bus to, say, the Shawangunk Ridge or Minnewaska State Park or the Ashoka Rail Trail, or any of the state parks, actually, where, you know, you have to pay an entrance fee, you also get in for free. And that's because Ulster County Tourism is taking part in this as well. So it's a really cool initiative. Not all three routes run every Saturday. They're going to rotate. So, you know, anybody who's interested in riding needs to check the schedule. But it's a really cool program. And I think it will really bolster tourism to the many beautiful natural landscapes here in Ulster County.
Okay, the Nature Bus is online at participate.ulstercountyny.gov. So the county's website has more information there, as well as the routes. Philip, I want to thank you once again for going over all this with us. We're talking with Philip Pantuso, managing editor for the Hudson Valley Bureau at Times Union. All the stories we've been talking about are up now at timesunion.com. Philip, thank you so much.
Take care.
And thanks to Jason Dole for that. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Capping off queer writers' residency at NACL and an homage to spring, NACL is ready to dance. Tomorrow at 7, it's the Outrageous Dance Party, and it's being held on the occasion of Beltane. What's that? Well, who better to ask than Brett Kaiser of NACL. Brett, hi.
Hi, Tim.
Thanks. Is it Beltane?
I believe it's Beltane. I'm not an expert either on the pronunciation or the actual roots of this pagan celebration.
It is a pagan holiday. So can you tell me a little bit about the pagan holiday?
I believe a maypole
may be involved.
Yes, typically a maypole. So my understanding is that – let me back up a second and say that last year NACL or North American Cultural Laboratory – put together some events for the community, and we decided that we were going to run them periodically. Our first one was a dance party called Rite of Spring that we co-presented with SADDP, or Seasonal Affective Disorder Dance Party. they were seasonal events, and so we lined them up roughly with there are quarter days, which are the equinoxes and the solstices, and then there are these events which are called cross quarter days, which fall roughly between the equinox and the solstice.
Right.
So Beltane is the one in spring, and it traditionally marks in the northern hemisphere the beginning of spring and the beginning of the planting season. So yeah. It's like a reemergence into new life after the dreary winter.
Sometimes goes by the name May Day, which some folks might be more familiar with in some ways.
For sure.
And celebrates the fertility and the height of spring and the coming summer.
Yes. So right. Come out and celebrate fertility at NACL. We're going to be dancing. One of the things about dance is that it's like a joyous way of moving into life together communally.
Right. So you're having an outrageous dance party
exactly.
Tomorrow at 7. I mentioned this is at the conclusion of the Queer Writers Residency. We had Julian Jimenez on earlier this week to talk about that. And they're presenting the workshop tonight. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
How's that been going?
It's amazing. I am with my job. I'm not always on site because I'm pushing out I'm out talking to people and hanging up posters and things like that. But my experience is that when I have been there this week have been just amazing. It's a really wonderful, crew of people. And if anyone's interested, check out their bios on NACL.org because there's some really, talented writers.
Yeah, Julian mentioned some of the folks, including the work that they are doing. And it's tonight at 7:30 at NACL in yep. Highland Lake. That's the reading of that, the workshop and all of that work. And as Julian mentioned, the safe space for folks to create and present this whole week at NACL. So the culmination tonight, exactly. And then that whole shake it off and let it go, Mayday Beltane party tomorrow.
Work it out. Yeah.
Well, who are some of the artists that are going to work it out tomorrow?
So for this event, we've been collaborating with two DJs. We have one DJ is DJ for the People, or Damani Moyd, who's known for his eclectic multi-genre mixes and live performances. Got his start in the LA rave scene in the 90s. And then we have DJ Cat Silk, who is, Damani, I should say, is from Port Jervis. DJ Cat Silk, who is Lonnie Chandra, we have Lonnie and Damani, is from Hankins. And she also sort of got her feet wet in the dance scene in San Francisco in the early 90s and then transitioned to New York City. Was working there in the underground dance scene. I should mention underground because at that time, a certain mayor deemed that dancing was equivalent with criminal activity and stopped renewing cabaret licenses.
and Cabernet.
Cabernet goes along with it. But yeah, so Lonnie is a local DJ and DJ and VJ who has also been working with us as a creative consultant on this piece. So Lindsay,
also a CJ.
Who is also works at NACL. Lindsay and I and Brendan have been like cranking out this week, turning the theater into a disco palace. that has been largely influenced by, we had this whiteboard that Lonnie's been contributing to every day. And it's
like, what's on the whiteboard?
Black lights, glow tape, silver foil, rain curtains.
There's a very retro inspired dance party.
Yes, exactly.
And to the point where on the website and in the press release, you remind folks of some inspiration about dressing the decade of their choice or mixing it up. So you want to talk a little bit about some of those recommendations?
It's 80s, 90s. Yeah. Right? So, and it's multi-generational, hitting people who were there in person and then people who, maybe
the
were
kids
not.
The kids are like, how did that happen?
But, there's been a resurgence recently in interest in particularly the 80s in that period. And, resamplings of cultural artifacts from that period.
Yeah, like
time.
Moose. Eyeshadow, zebra tights, shoulder pads, acid wash, high top Reeboks. There's an 80s reference for you. Headbands, lots of rubber bracelets, cargo pants, baggy jeans, waffle long johns. Do I remember those?
That's 90s.
That's
grunge,
more 90s.
Right?
Oh, like a grungy. Oh, I see. Like, we're talking about that. Yeah. Well, see, I'm combining it.
Yeah. You can combine them. You can be creative.
You're allowed to? Okay.
Yeah, sure.
Sky pager. Oh, I remember the pager.
Remember the sky pager.
Oh, my gosh, a pager. That was the height of technology.
And you would clip it on your.
Yeah, you clip it.
So that people would see that you had it.
And then do you remember, like, creating words out of the numbers and then, like, holding it upside down? Hello.
Every age has its.
Oh, dear. Remember it all tomorrow at NACL. Doors open when and what's going on in terms of food? I understand some Korean delicacies.
Yes, indeed. So doors open at 7 o'clock. The dancing show spectacle extravaganza begins at 7:30. But if you show up early, you can have food, Korean inspired street food from the Bibimbus, which is a project by Narrowsburg local Kai Brasil and his grandmother, Sonia.
Good food.
It's amazing food. So definitely show up early, get some Korean, have a drink, get set up. And then we also have two other performers, Hillary Melker Chapman and Karina Grun, who will be doing their aerialist, amazing stuff.
Cool.
All of this really is a communal event, but it's really been greatly supported from the business community. Local businesses that are behind this have been so supportive. We have Two Queens, Lit Home and Book, Upward Brewing Company, Calicoon Pantry, Cottage Wines, Sullivan Sundries, Calicoon Wine Merchant, the Chi Hive, the River Valerie, the River Gallery, and Sullivan County Visitors Association. So people have just really been both of these events, the Outrage and Outrageous.
Outrageous. Outrageous tomorrow, the dance party at 7 at NACL in Highland Lake. More information at nacl.org. And I'm just going to quote from your press release here. Come, let it all out, shake it up, whip it good, strike a pose, turn around, don't leave your cake out in the rain, because they're going to party like it's 1999 or 1979 or any night in between.
You heard it here.
Get ready. All right, Brett Kaiser from NACL, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tim.
All right, that's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. You can hear this episode, previous episodes, and all of our local programming on our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Jason Tuga. This Friday on The Mixtape, we will listen to a carefully curated set of Joy Division and New Order covers. Far-flung artists in all different styles and genres. Listen on air at 90.5 FM, or on your phone or smart speaker, or online at wjffradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Sunny day today, some clouds in the afternoon, a high of 62, 37 and clear tonight. Cloudy tomorrow and a high of 60, and Sunday, high of 77, 84 on Monday. On Point is next from WBUR Boston. It's 11 o'clock.